Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and examine President Obama's budget and its chances of success as revenues decline and credit remains frozen. We'll be speaking with Steve Ellis, who's Vice President of Programs at Taxpayers for Common Sense. Steve has testified before numerous congressional committees as a spokesperson for Taxpayers for Common Sense, who are a nonpartisan watchdog group focusing on budget issues, ending earmarks and corporate welfare, and holding decision makers accountable. We'll also, if we can get through to this woman who runs a food bank, she's obviously overwhelmed at the moment, and talk about the social impact of the deteriorating economy and the extent that the stimulus will stave off the hardships of millions of Americans who are losing homes and jobs. And we'll then talk about some hopeful signs in Iraq and, of course, growing signs of hopelessness in Pakistan, which, of course, impacts on Afghanistan. We'll be joined by Robert Dreyfuss, investigative journalist, specialized in politics and national security, is the author of Devil's Game, How the United States Helped Unleash Fundamentalist Islam. And he's a contributing editor to The Nation magazine and a frequent contributor to Rolling Stone and The American Prospector and Mother Jones. He has a new piece in The Nation on hopeful signs of an emerging nation in Iraq, and he's covered also a battle behind the scenes to appoint Ambassador Chas Freeman to the chair of the National Intelligence Council. And then we'll examine the global instability as a result of economic distress that the new director of national intelligence warned about. We'll be talking with Dr. Michael Clare, who's a five-collegist professor of peace and world security studies at Hampshire College. He's the author of 13 books, the most recent, Resource Wars and Blood and Oil, The Dangers and Consequences of America's Growing Petroleum Dependency. His latest book is Rising Powers, Shrinking Planet, and the New Geopolitics of Energy. And he's also been writing in Foreign Policy and Focus, and he has a new article, of course, in Salon.com entitled We Are on the Brink of Disaster. So we'll be looking at that. Let's begin with the president's budget. And as I mentioned, I'm joined by Steve Ellis, who's Vice President of Programs at the Taxpayers for Common Sense. He's testified a number of times before numerous congressional committees and as a spokesperson for Taxpayers for Common Sense, which is a nonpartisan watchdog group who focus on budget issues, ending earmarks and corporate welfare, and holding decision makers accountable. And it would seem, Steve, that President Obama is to some extent holding a lot of people accountable and really changing the nature of the priorities of our society, which since Ronald Reagan, essentially, American democracy has been of the rich, by the rich, or at least the agents of the rich, and for the rich.
Well, he certainly has, and he's only pretty early on in his administration, but has made some demands and shaken things up, and certainly his budget has got some things that we would say that we like from a budgetary perspective and things we don't like. I mean, certainly he has demanded that Congress see the stimulus as more than just a trough for earmarks and for parochial spending provisions, but we'll have to see exactly how the money is doled out on the back end. And then on his budget, he has, certainly recognized and understandably that we're going to have huge budget deficits here in the short term. We were a bit disappointed that he wasn't aggressively trying to reduce the deficit, as he went further along, which means we're going to end up having a lot more debt to pay off, even in 10 years hence.
But hasn't, accept the premise, though, that since Ronald Reagan, essentially, the priorities in Washington have largely favored the wealthy, and President Bush, of course, went all out in terms of and we've seen the results. We've seen a massive transfer of wealth to a very small minority of people, and the middle class is sort of becoming impoverished, and a vast, uncounted working class in this country, even though we pride ourselves on being a middle-class country. We're 53% of our citizens earn less than $30,000 a year. It seems that for the longest time this has been accepted, but you get the impression at least there's going to be a little bit of a reversal of that trend.
I mean, that all has to play out. You know, I mean, we'll have to see exactly what comes to pass as far as his proposals and what actually gets enacted. I mean, certainly in the stimulus, I mean, one of the things that we were generally supportive of, and I think most economists were supportive of, was the fact that you would target more of the stimulus, especially the savings, towards people on the lower level of the income strata, you know, even below the middle class, just because they're the most likely people to spend it rather than saving it. And so, you know, I think it's early to say whether there's been a fundamental shift. I think some people might have argued that there would be a fundamental shift at the beginning of the Clinton administration back in the early 90s, and I don't think that necessarily came to pass. So it will have to see exactly what plays out as it goes forward. Certainly the dynamic has changed, and you would figure with the Democratic Congress, they're going to be likely to go along with it. But we've more concentrated on the macro budget issues rather than who's the winners or losers, particularly in the budget as far as people go.
I see. Well, I do detect in the media there's at least more than equal time for the Republicans, who appear to be somewhat discredited given the nature of the economy as a result of their policies. And there's lots of cries from those quarters about socialism. So I'm assuming that there's something in this new direction that alarms a lot of people on the right in this country. But what about the notion then, Steve Ellis, of how this budget depends upon? I mean, how can it be successful if revenues continue to decline? And apparently, revenues are declining at an alarming rate, and credit remains frozen.
Well, and actually, it isn't going to get better in the near term. I mean, 2009, the budget deficit is predicted to be $1.75 trillion. 2010, it's 1.2. It's not until 2010, according to their budget, we start climbing out of the recession. We're starting to see a recovery if you look at their predicted GDP figures, and then the revenues and the expenditures roughly stay pace. The thing is that they kind of lock in a structural deficit of $500 to $600 billion, even though we'll be spending a lot more as a nation. And in the budget, we're talking about shifting from about a $3.1 trillion budget in 2008 to $3 trillion budget in 2008, to about $3.5 trillion in 2012, and then it just slowly goes up from there. So we've definitely bumped up a significant amount. I know I'm throwing out a lot of numbers, but the concern that we have is that, you know, we've unfortunately in the last administration, budget discipline really went out the window. And, you know, at a time when we had, you know, significant amount of the Bush administration, we had a pretty good economy, is when we should have been making sure that we were getting closer to balance, and we didn't. And so that put us in a position where we have very little slack. We went from a $5.7 trillion debt when President Bush took office to a $10.7 trillion debt when he left office. But under the recent proposal from the president, we're looking at, in 10 years' time, adding another $6 trillion in debt, not even coming close to sort of whittling out of the hole, but digging it deeper.
And Steve Ellis, what do you make of the $634 billion that's been set aside in reserve fund for health care reform, which appears to be a move towards health insurance coverage for all Americans?
Well, it appears to be a move towards something. You know, I mean, essentially what they did, and I think it was smart, as long as they keep people's grubby mitts off it, is essentially say, well, we're going to work out with Congress and the country the plan, but we're going to put some money, a plug into the budget to help offset that cost. And I think that's a responsible approach. I think everybody recognizes that Medicare and the cost of health care in the country is a ticking time bomb for our budget and obviously just for the health and well-being of our citizens. That said, you know, we've got to walk and chew gum at the same time. We're in a very bad budgetary spot. And so, you know, instead of just piling healthcare reform, Medicare reform on top of everything that we've always been doing, we actually need to set some priorities. We need to cut some wasteful spending in Department of Defense. We need to cut some wasteful spending in USDA. We need to cut some spending in areas across the budget where either the government shouldn't be there or it's not the highest priority, and we've got other priorities, bigger fish to fry, such as healthcare.
Well, there have been some cuts announced in agribusiness, but it's pretty murky about exactly how much the Pentagon's going to be cut and how much the president's going to take on procurement. I know John McCain, in that summit that they had in the White House recently, challenged the president to be more aggressive in taking on the scandal at the Pentagon vis-a-vis procurement. But, of course, in the president's defense, at least they're counting the Iraq war and the Afghan war. I mean, it's pretty scandalous, isn't it, that some of the biggest outlays that the government haven't even been counted? I mean, who are they trying to fool?
No, I mean, we've always advocated that the war, at least after the initial year, maybe even 2 years, should have been on budget, because we were essentially budgeting the only number we knew was not correct, which was zero. And so, you know, we certainly were happy to see that it moved on budget. One thing that is kind of interesting and ironic about that, though, is that when you do a 10-year budget window, so we had $75 billion in for this year. He has $150 billion, I think it is, for next year. But then you start reaping savings all the way through the out years. So he benefits from moving it on budget by the fact that if you never put it on budget, then you wouldn't be able to realize the savings in your budgetary numbers. But on balance, we certainly agree, think that if you know that there's going to be an expense, even if you don't know what the final number is, you need to put something in there, or else it's a bigger hole in your budget, and certainly a larger deficit than it appears to be on paper.
Well, just in closing, then, Steve Ellis, the president himself mentioned the frozen credit and the paralysis with the banks as the biggest issue determining the fate of the global economy and the outcome of his own stimulus package. Yet we seem to be in this strange world where they're incrementally giving money to Citibank and I guess Bank of America will probably be the next in at the trough. And a lot of economists like Krugman and others are saying that unless you bite the bullet and nationalize the banks, you're going to have the zombie bank situation that the Japanese had for 10 years. And that they're not being bold enough, and they're just sort of dithering here. Do you have any explanation for this, if this is true, and if this is the key to reviving the economy, to unlock, unfreeze the banks? All of our discussion to hear today about the budget is sort of out the window, isn't it? And so what determines this apparent impasse?
Well, certainly, I mean, you're right about that. The budget kind of goes out the window, that essentially if we don't recover, if our economy doesn't recover in the next 2 years, we're still in recession, then basically everything that's in the budget just kind of goes out the window, including the reserve fund for healthcare, et cetera. But, you know, I think that there is a risk that if you keep trying to pick sort of the middle way, that nationalization is too scary and allowing banks to fail is too scary, kind of the two opposite areas, so to speak, then you catch yourself in a no man's land where nobody really is confident, and you're not allowing it to get worse before it gets better, and you're not like making your bold changes to try to jumpstart it right now, and so then you kind of sit in this stagnant intermediary period, and that's a real risk. And unfortunately, nobody, not even a Nobel Prize laureate like Krugman, knows the answer. You know, I mean, people are still analyzing, and the Fed chairman has written books about the Depression. I mean, people are still analyzing what should have been done during the Great Depression, what caused the Great Depression, and certainly still people are talking about what happened in Japan. And so we are in uncharted waters, but you definitely think that history rewards the bold. And so I'm certainly not arguing for nationalization. I mean, that's not my skill set to be able to argue one way or another there. But certainly you want to make sure that you're making your mark and you're doing what you can to get the economy going and that it all fits into a grand scheme.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here in Los Angeles today, Steve Ellis.
Thank you for having me. Take care.
Thank you. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Steve Ellis, who's the Vice President of Programs at Taxpayers for Common Sense. He's testified before numerous congressional committees as a spokesperson for Taxpayers for Common Sense, a nonpartisan watchdog group who focus on budget issues, ending earmarks and corporate welfare, and holding decision makers accountable. I'm now speaking with Robert Dreyfuss, who's an investigative journalist specializing in politics and national security. He's the author of Devil's Game, How the United States Helped Unleash Fundamentalist Islam. A Nation contributed editor, he is also a frequent contributor to Rolling Stone, The American Prospect, and Mother Jones. He has a new piece in The Nation on hopeful signs of an emerging nation in Iraq, and he's also been covering the behind-the-scenes battles to appoint Ambassador Chaz Freeman to the chair of the National Intelligence Council. So we have a sort of good news and bad news out there, it seems, Robert Dreyfuss, particularly in terms of hopeful signs that you see in Iraq, but also growing signs of hopelessness in Pakistan, which, of course, impacts on Afghanistan.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't say Pakistan is hopeless yet, but it's definitely a troubling situation. And I wouldn't say that Iraq is exactly a success yet. It's moving kind of in the right direction, but it's still a very violent country with enormous political differences that could explode. So in both cases, I think the future is kind of, you know, murky in terms of where this is all going.
But I take it that when you talk about success in Iraq, it's not going to be anything that was advertised initially by President Bush bringing democracy to the Middle East and et cetera, et cetera. Whatever we end up with there, it seems that the bar has been lowered to the point where we just want to be able to get the hell out of there without leaving a mess behind.
Well, look, we're leaving a mess behind. I mean, Iraq is a devastated country. It's suffered hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people killed. Its economy is shattered. I don't know how many countless hundreds of thousands, probably millions of children are orphans, suffering deep psychological wounds. There have been 2 million people who fled the country into neighboring countries. This is a devastated country that has been, if not destroyed, severely damaged. So whatever we leave behind in Iraq is nothing we can be proud of. I think it's a testament to Iraqis that the country is starting to recover after having been basically stomped on by the United States for the past 6 years. And for most Iraqis, you know, we can't go too soon. Now, they don't want a civil war to reignite. But I think that most Iraqis, as evidenced by the man who threw his shoe at President Bush late last year, aren't exactly enamored of America. So, no, we're not exactly leaving behind a pro-American democracy there. We're leaving behind an extremely damaged country, which is going to take a generation to recover.
And do you think that...
And by the way, I'd like to hear President Obama apologize for that. I'd like to hear him apologize to the Iraqis for the destruction that we've wreaked on their country, rather than, speaking to a bunch of Hua Marines down at Camp Lejeune and babbling on about the great victory that they've all achieved in Iraq. Why doesn't President Obama apologize to the Iraqis for the destruction we've caused in their country for no damn good reason?
Well, a lot of people believe that the initial shock and awe, the destruction, the willful destruction of Iraqi infrastructure, is in fact a war crime.
Well, you'd have to be brain dead to not consider it a war crime. And besides, the whole war was illegal. So, I mean, this is an absurd situation. And it's true that the United States has, you know, the collective attention of the country has kind of turned the page on Iraq. I think Americans are tired of reading about it. I find, as a writer, when I talk to editors and, you know, say, hey, I want to write about Iraq, they say, oh, no, we're not interested. What do you know about Afghanistan? Or, you know, so I think it's a...
Well, they're closing bureaus there as well, the media are, and cutting back on coverage. But
Yeah, and it's expensive, too. You know, the media is in an economic downturn like everybody else, and because Iraq is not exactly a shining democracy, to have reporters over there, you got to spend a fortune on security and all kinds of logistical precautions and communications equipment and everything else. So it's expensive to be over there, and the media finds it doesn't sell. So, like I said, they're turning the page, and I think, you know, Obama promised during the campaign that he would draw troops down, and so he's carrying that forward, although there's a lot of questions that remain about what we leave there in terms of a residual force. I think there's still a lot of people in this country, in the United States, who think that the United States has some kind of claim on Iraq in terms of primacy about, you know, oil contracts and security and plain old American influence in the Persian Gulf, which to some degree, at least, was what this war was about in the first place, kind of planting the American flag at the heart of the world's oil real estate. So there's a lot of questions that still remain about our departure from Iraq, but then, of course, the Iraqis get a vote on that, too.
Well, the theory is, at least from what the president announced at Camp Lejeune, is that they pull the bulk of the forces out by the summer of next year, leaving behind 50,000 largely to train the Iraqi army, and then some kind of, you know, indefinite period, whatever that will take, before we're out of there altogether. What just dealing with the premise of the Iraqi army? So, is that possible that you'll have an army that'll actually serve the country and stabilize? And obviously, it will be Maliki's army, won't it?
Well, first of all, it isn't so indefinite. I mean, by the virtues of the U.S.-Iraq agreement that we signed, all the U.S. troops have to be out by the end of 2011, which is 14 months after Obama says he would remove all the combat troops. So the other 35 to 50,000 that he's talking about are supposed to leave 14 months later. Now, that agreement could be renegotiated, but then that would bring it up against the growing power of Iraqi nationalism. I don't think Iraqis particularly want American troops to stay there. Second point to make is, in July, I believe, there's supposed to be a referendum by Iraqis on the U.S.-Iraq agreement. If they vote it down, and I guess it's possible they may do that, then the United States has 12 remaining months to get all the troops out, which means by July of next year, all 140,000 troops would have to leave because they'd have no legal basis to stay any longer. So that's the first two points about the troops. The Iraqi army has been reconstituted by Prime Minister Maliki as kind of his own private militia. He's installed most of the commanders and generals. He's bypassing the parliament and even the army chief of staff and so on to put, you know, reach down directly into the ranks. And he's using the army as kind of a battering ram against some of his political opponents, most notably the Sadrists, the followers of the rebel cleric Muqtada al-Sadr, who has been a force in Iraq for many years. And where this all goes is a big question mark, and no one really knows where the loyalties of the Iraqi army are. There's a lot of militia guys from different political factions, the Kurds and others who make up the rank and file. It's not like most national armies that are organized according to discipline and order. It's a kind of a hodgepodge.
You mentioned Robert Dreyfus, the Kurdish forces, the Peshmerga, and of course the Kurds are divided between two clans, the Barzanis and the Talibanis. And Barzanis has done some rather treacherous things over the years. He's apparently stirring the pot there in Mosul, which is apparently something of a booby trap situation, because Saddam moved Sunnis in there to ethnically cleanse the Kurds. They want to come back in. That's always been a flashpoint. How's Maliki going to finesse that?
Well, I think the real flashpoint is not Mosul, but Kirkuk.
Because the oil, you mean?
Well, no, because the Kurds have a claim to Kirkuk as part of historic Kurdistan, much less so in Mosul, which, by everybody's admission, is a vastly Sunni majority province, and the recent elections proved that, where a Sunni nationalist party got almost half the vote in the province. In Kirkuk, the things are so troubled that they couldn't even have provincial elections there. They postponed those to some future date. It's certainly a flashpoint for conflict, and you're right, there's a lot of oil that floats around under that province. So the Kurds, to the extent that they entertain the fantasy that they can have an independent country, would like to get their hands on that oil in order to provide an economic engine for an independent Kurdistan. Safe to say that that won't happen, because neither Iraq's Arabs nor Turkey and probably nor Iran would allow an independent Kurdish state to emerge. But it does provide a potential flashpoint for conflict in Iraq, and a lot of people think that between now and the end of the year, that's going to be the single biggest problem that Iraq faces as it moves toward greater independence from the United States.
Well, apparently a Norwegian company was contracted by the Kurds to develop an oil field, which they've done, and now apparently it's successful. But now the question is, who gets the money? Does Maliki's central government get it, or do the Kurds get it?
Well, I don't think the Kurds have contracted for Kirkuk oil yet, because that's still under the control of the central government. But there has not been yet passed a clearly defined oil law in Iraq that would apportion whether the central government or the provinces, get what from what oil. It seems logical that since oil is confined to a few provinces, that the central government has to get the vast bulk of that revenue and then use it for the development of the country as a whole. You can't let the oil be apportioned to the provinces where the oil wells happen to be. But that's something that the Iraqi political system has to grapple with, and it's an extremely explosive issue for Iraqis.
Let's change subjects a little, Robert Dreyfus. I just wanted to touch on this battle that's been going on behind the scenes that you've written about in The Nation, about the appointment of Ambassador Chaz Freeman to the chair of the National Intelligence Council. He's been on this program a few times and is one of the more erudite analysts I've ever talked to. I think he's very, very, to put it simply, a very wise man. So who would be trying to deny that kind of talent to the United States government?
Well, the the origin of the opposition to Chas Freeman basically comes from the Israel lobby, and specifically from its far-right fringe. They began beating the drums about a week or a week and a half ago when the news of the nomination of Chas Freeman to the post of National Intelligence Council was announced. Now, this post, you should understand, puts him in charge of assembling the product of 16 different intelligence agencies and overseeing the production of, among other things, the national intelligence estimates that have traditionally been produced by the intelligence community as kind of the distilled version of, you know, what we know about global affairs.
Also, the president's daily briefing isn't that a product that the DNI puts out now?
The DNI, yes, but the National Intelligence Council is simply an arm of the DNI. It all kind of goes into that. But the president's brief is not produced by the National Intelligence Council per se. But in any case, the opposition to Freeman was provoked by the fact that he is an Arabist, someone who is not only was strongly opposed to the Iraq war and to the political faction of the neoconservatives that promoted that war, but someone who has long been a critic, a harsh critic of Israel and its treatment of the Palestinians. Freeman has been a proponent of a stronger American pressure on Israel to make a deal with the Palestinians that would allow a coherent and independent political state to emerge for Palestine. So because of that, I think primarily because of his views on Israel, and because he's seen as an Arabist, he was attacked by this sort of phalanx of the Zionist lobby spokesman. The high point, I guess, was an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal, but there were articles in the Weekly Standard and various blogs and the New Republic and so forth, all of which kind of harped on Freeman as a dangerous, one person called him a radical in the Washington Post. All of that is nonsense. I mean, he's an extremely judicious, even-handed, and intelligent guy who does have strong views on things, but they just happen not to be the views that cohere with what the Israel lobby wants. In any case, despite their best efforts, he did get appointed. And I think that's a testimony to the strength of his relationship to Admiral Blair, who's the new intelligence director, but also apparently at least to the White House, which didn't cave in under this pressure.
Which is unusual, actually, because normally AIPAC gets their way in terms of people who get appointed to the National Security Council in any kind of portfolio to do with the Middle East.
They've been, you know, the AIPAC crowd has been getting increasingly nervous these days. They didn't like the appointment of Jim Jones as National Security Advisor because he was seen as too close to the Palestinians. He spent the last year before the election in Palestine working with the Palestinians on the ground in the West Bank to build security arrangements. They didn't like the appointment of George Mitchell, who was seen as too even-handed, somebody who would not be a lawyer for Israel in the talks with the Palestinians. And several other appointments were troubling as well, so I think they picked on this Chas Freeman appointment as, you know, kind of a place where they could make their stand, and they lost that one too. So I have a feeling that they're getting quite worried. And of course, the big thing that worries the Israel lobby in Washington is that a proto-lunatic is about to become prime minister of Israel. Bibi Netanyahu, is seen as far to the right of the Israeli political spectrum, and his political allies, in turn, are far to the right of him. So it looks like that the new Israeli government is going to be a huge public relations problem for the Israel lobby in Washington, and something that they're going to find very difficult, I believe, to defend over the coming months.
Well, it seems as though, in terms of Israeli politics, it seems like the center, Kadima, which Tzipi Livni represents, and Labor on the left, have decided to cut loose from any possibility of a coalition with Netanyahu and Lieberman, and essentially basically doing a kind of Pavlovian exercise on the Israeli public, saying, "Okay, you guys, if you want to if you want to have the right wing run this country and run it into the ground and create a complete catastrophe, here it is. We're not going to participate. We're going to go into the opposition."
People might argue that that's already happened. I mean, the right wing has been basically running Israel since the late 70s when the Likud party won the elections and put Menachem Begin in power.
But it's like what happened here in this country. The right wing had a long project starting with Reagan, and they culminated in getting George Bush in there, and they got to practice their ideological expertise, and look where it's got us. So
yeah, what I mean is that you mentioned Livni as representing the political center. I mean, she runs a party that was founded by Ariel Sharon, who a generation ago was seen as a fanatical right wing extremist in the Israeli political spectrum. So the idea that Ariel Sharon's party, namely Kadima, could be seen as the center now shows you how incredibly far to the right Israel has drifted. And in fact, it's fair to say, I think, that a government made up of Netanyahu and Avigdor Lieberman, who are plain and simple fanatics, is the exact mirror image of a government in Gaza made up of Hamas, who are fanatics. So you have the situation between Israel and Palestine becoming increasingly polarized with fanatics in power. I attribute that directly to 8 years of neglect by George Bush, mm-hmm. who, by avoiding any kind of negotiation efforts, by letting things just kind of develop on their own, he let things spiral out of control. So now you have nutcases running Gaza, and you have nutcases running Israel. And walking back from that precipice is going to be extremely difficult for President Obama.
I thank you so much for joining us here in Los Angeles, Robert Dreyfus.
My pleasure.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then, Robert Dreyfus, investigative journalist, specialized in politics and national security. He's the author of The Devil's Game, How the United States Helped Unleash Fundamentalist Islam, a contributing editor to The Nation, excuse me, and a frequent contributor to Rolling Stone, The American Prospect, and Mother Jones. And now we're going to talk about how the global instability is causing this economic distress that the new director of national intelligence warned about. We'll be joined now by Dr. Michael Clare, who's a Fife College professor of peace and world security studies located at Hampshire College. He's the journalist and author of 13 books. His most recent is Resource Wars and Blood and Oil, The Dangers and Consequences of America's Growing Petroleum Dependency. And his latest book is Rising Powers, Shrinking Planet, The New Geopolitics of Energy, soon to be published in a paperback edition. Dr. Clare also serves on the board of directors of Human Rights Watch and the Arms Control Association, and he's a regular contributor to many publications, including The Nation, for whom he is the defense correspondent, Tom Dispatch, Mother Jones, Foreign Policy and Focus, and others. He has a new article, Insulon.com, entitled We're on the Brink of Disaster. And that article, Michael Clare, of course, does echo the warnings that came from Admiral Blair recently that the economic meltdown, this global economic crisis, will create some civil unrest, and we're already starting to see it now in Athens, in China, in Haiti, in Latvia, Bolivia, Bulgaria, Lithuania, in Vladivostok, in Russia, and in Reykjavik, in Iceland, in Paris, Rome, Zaragoza, and Moscow, and in Dublin. And people are mad as hell, and they're not going to take it anymore. Is that what's going on?
Well, I think it's less a matter of people being, you know, having a conscious sense of being mad about something as people being terrified about what's to come and sort of striking out at whatever spark ignites them. I think there's a tremendous amount of fear and anxiety in the world, and this is only going to increase as economic conditions deteriorate and more people are being put at risk. So you have tremendous anxiety, and almost anything will ignite that. And this is throughout the world. In every continent, you could see examples of this.
Well, the DNI, his report suggested, or at least his testimony to the Senate, said he said that as bad as the economy is here in the United States, it's the impact of this global recession slash depression is going to be felt much more acutely in China and Russia, and in particular the former Warsaw Pact countries. So, is there anything in the list that I just read off there that shows any kind of consistency in terms of whether this is just some inchoate movement that's just angry about conditions and terrified of where things are heading? For example, in Vladivostok, apparently they were angry at the Moscow for putting tariffs on secondhand Japanese cars that they were able to get fairly cheaply, as opposed to the local product. And in Dublin, for example, what were they in the streets about in Dublin?
I think in Dublin and in Athens, in the Western European countries, the fear is that the good times that we've had in the past decade or so are coming to an end, that people have gotten accustomed to upper middle class quality of life are going to be pushed back to lower middle class conditions, that people who have risen out of the poor to live a lower middle class way of life are going to be pushed back into the poor. I think this is a uniform fear across the European countries, worse in Eastern Europe. When you look in the developing world, it's much more harsh, because here I'm talking about, say, parts of India, large parts of Africa and Latin America. We're now facing places where there may not be enough food to eat. And this is where there's something that's very unique about this depression that separates it from all previous depressions, is that the economic crisis is now intersecting the environmental crisis of climate change, of global warming, and extreme drought in many parts of the world. So the price of food is beginning to rise due to excessive drought. And so people who have less money are going to be forced to pay more for food and simply may not be able to buy it.
So you, Michael Clare, are referring to a depression, not a recession. So give us a definition of where you think we are in terms of this sort of semantical dance that goes on between, optimistic economists who say it's a recession and pessimistic ones who say it's a depression.
Mm. Let me preface my words by saying I'm a political scientist and a conflict analyst, not an economist. So I don't want anybody to accuse me of being imprecise, but I say this because, my experience in my lifetime of recessions are bad things that last for a year or so. And I think all economists that I'm reading are saying, what we have now is going to last for 2 years at the minimum. And in my mind, that distinguishes what we have now from a recession.
So is this then just the beginning of manifestations of civil unrest that we're going to be seeing now for years on our television sets?
I would say yes. I would have to say that is a realistic projection. For example, Admiral Blair, the director of national intelligence, in his testimony says that computer simulations suggest that when recessions last for more than a year or so, for a year or two, you have a greater increase of, and this is a quote, regime-threatening instability, which is a new term, so far as I know, in Pentagonese, at least when we're talking about economically related instability. So certainly the U.S. intelligence agencies anticipate an increase in this kind of violence, and we've already passed the one-year mark for this recession/depression, and everybody says it's going to be at least 2 years, because they're now saying it'll be at least till 2010 before we see any improvement. That makes 2 years. So yes, I think we'll see more of this. And his testimony goes on to describe a variety of, or rather a whole set of scenarios or places where we're likely to see more economically driven conflict.
So economically driven conflict that threatens stabilities of regimes, and I guess there's no coherence or consistency here as to whether good regimes survive and bad regimes are overthrown.
Well, I think that's a good way of putting it, Ian. It's totally unpredictable because, and first of all, what's a good regime and what's a bad regime?
Well, let's say Zimbabwe is a bad one and Botswana is a good one.
Yeah, it's entirely a matter of how many, you know, what your foreign currency reserves are, how strong your ability to withstand crisis, especially crisis that sweeps over you from elsewhere, is. And good and bad does make a difference here. Countries that are well-governed probably have greater resiliency. But on the other hand, bad regimes like Zimbabwe also have greater investment in police and military forces to put down their public.
Well, we just Mark and Claire, the European ministers all met to face their economic crisis, which is worse than ours, it appears, and it's not unrelated since the subprime toxic securities that we foisted on the rest of the world ended up dragging Europe down as well. So presumably, I mean, one would expect that some of what's happening out there will have an anti-American tinge just because we're the ones that started the contagion that has spread all around the world. But the ministers meeting, the European ministers, did not, they decided against bailing out the Eastern Europeans. They basically want to take care of themselves. So when Admiral Blair says that the former Warsaw Pact countries are probably not going to survive this recession intact, what does that mean? Does that mean that the Soviet Union might reconstitute itself if all these satellites collapse? Who would pick up the pieces?
Well, that's the important question, and that should be a source of worry to everyone. It's not that the Soviet Union is likely to pick up the pieces. What we have to worry about is, you know, let's look at history here. What happened the last time we faced conditions like that? We're talking about the 1930s, and there you saw the rise of ultra governments of one sort or another that borrowed in various forms from socialism, communism, and Nazism. And that's what I would fear, in this case, attacks on immigrants, which is rising throughout that region, brutal attacks on immigrants. Gypsies are under attack. I haven't heard reports of increases in anti-Semitism, but it wouldn't surprise me if we would see that sort of thing underway. So I think you will, or at least I would fear, a rise in extremist movements or left from left or right.
So what do you think it will happen in terms of the Obama administration's ability to deal with these issues that we're talking about that are beginning to emerge as the global economic meltdown manifests itself in terms of street protests and social distress, given that he's got his hands full with trying to get out of Iraq without that blowing up, figuring out what to do in Afghanistan, where nobody has any much optimism about that one. That's pretty much taken up most of our treasure and most of our military assets. So what are we going to do about all this stuff?
Yeah, he's got people who are probably worrying about this 24 hours a day, exactly this question. Now his chief intelligence advisor, Dennis Blair, has clearly warned him about this because that's his job. And he has said, that is to say, President Obama has said that his biggest worry is Pakistan, which represents some elements of this. I mean, part of the violence in Pakistan is driven by economically driven conflict. The differing economic status of some of the different groups within Pakistan, which extremists exploit.
Pakistan, of course, has over half of its economy is a black economy and has tremendous stresses internally. The government appears to be weak and caving into the Islamists, and on top of that, this weak and unpopular government just basically banned the other civilian party, which indicates even more political instability.
Yes, and when we tend to talk about these, and when the media reports on Pakistan or Mexico or Afghanistan, and we hear about the internal conflicts like you described in Pakistan, they tend to be described as political or ethnic disputes. But very often we're talking about corruption and various forms of party payoffs and various rackets that all of these groups are associated with. I mean, now even it's publicly said that in Afghanistan, the president and his associates are deeply involved in corruption, that the warlords are deep into the drug traffic. So when we hear that this is an ideological war about terrorism, a lot of the fighting is much more closely tied to the livelihoods of various gangs and militias and criminal enterprises.
Well, that certainly seems to be the case in Mexico as well.
Absolutely.
So is this to say then, Michael Clare, that this global instability as a result of the economic meltdown is going to be a boom for organized crime?
Absolutely. And let me put in context that a lot of the violence in the world before the economic crisis was about the fact that globalization and the economic bubble market of the 1990s and early 21st century benefited some people, but not all people. There were large parts of the world, the Mexican slums, slums throughout the world, where many, many people did not see any benefit of in their lives. And it was these people who were drawn to either criminal gangs or extremist movements, and as we say, we were saying, in many parts of the world, there's no distinction between, or just a thin distinction between, the criminal gangs and the ideological movements. And now, with the global economic crisis, these linked criminal organizations slash insurgent movements are going to be more powerful than ever, because poor people everywhere are going to see them as the only way to survive in an economically depressed world.
Well, Dr. Michael Clare, I thank you so much for joining us here in Los Angeles.
It's been my pleasure, Ian. Take care.
You too. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm speaking then with Dr. Michael Clare, the Five Colleges Professor of Peace and World Security Studies based at Hampshire College. He had an article in the current issue of Salon.com or online entitled, "We Are on the Brink of Disaster." I'd like to thank the producer, Louis Vandenberg, the associate producer, Elliot Fong, and Tamika Zoghi, the engineer.